Hi, I'm Richard Grove, and this is School Sucks Across America, day number 3 in Hartford, Connecticut. School sucks, but you don't have to.
This is weird because I don't think I've ever interviewed you about you before. We've always had something to talk about.
You want to just warm up by talking about my book?
Yeah. I know you've been working on this book for the better part of, 2 years, 3 years?
Well, if you count actually doing the research that it takes to write the book, like 13 years.
Right. And this was this the genesis of this in a truth about video that you had written?
Okay, so the genesis was first, that'll tie into my school sucks moment later.
All right.
Because it was a blind spot on my history map.
Right.
So there becomes the awareness of the blind spot, and then your due diligence to try to fill that in yourself since education didn't give that to you.
Right. Right. Right.
So it's like discovering a national park with the tallest mountain in the world that exists, but no one ever told you about it.
Right.
You'd be like, where is that? Who created the national park? Or a city. Like, you'd ask who built the city and how long has it been there? What did they do? And these sort of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So over the years, I started to, first, there's the awareness of the Rothschild banking family, because Carol Quigley mentions it in Tragedy and Hope. And then that was like, well, surely I have a college education if that existed, if that family was real. So then I was like skeptical that I was like, Quigley's full of shit. Pardon my French. But then you look on the internet and you see all these websites with accusations and stories and
about this family.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But that, to me, that's hearsay. Like, it involves a lot of belief on my part to read that and not be super critical of it, because there's no primary sources, right? But then you get to the point where you're like, okay, let me just start searching what's in the literature. Let me go to Amazon. Let me go to ABE Books, which is the American Book Exchange, good place to get used books. Type in Rothschild in the title. Start looking for books 40 plus years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. There's a whole bunch of books written in the 1800s, 1900s on this family. Some of them are 2-volume sets. So I started collecting those books over the years. And once I got to like 50 or so of these books, biographies, autobiographies, and a couple books of the really close working families, like the Warburgs and some of the other families that they worked really close with over multiple generations, then I felt like, oh, I could write a book on this. And so that's the naivete that starts you down the road.
How far in the past are we when you said that moment I could write a book on this?
Like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. Okay.
But I had no motivation at that point. I was already like making documentaries, doing the podcast, maintaining the Tragedy and Hope community. I had a whole bunch of things I was already juggling.
Right.
I got lots of good plans for the future and projects and all that stuff, but it's like single threaded. So you do as its priorities.
Right.
So it didn't really come up on the prioritization until Michael DeMarco from Stephen Molyneux's group.
Yep.
Because there's also Matthew DeMonaco from Libsyn or Podomatic that I work with, so I don't want to make it. So it's Michael DeMonaco.
DeMarco.
DeMarco.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for, that little correction. Works with Stephen, and he said, hey, Steph wants to do a truth about the Rothschilds.
Interesting. Right.
He thought you might, and I said, yeah, I've had a project that I've wanted to like put together, and now you guys are giving me a like perfect excuse. They wanted an hour of content, and I said, okay. And then after a couple weeks, because I asked what the deadline was, and so a couple weeks into the project, I said, look, to deliver an hour of content is impossible in the deadline because there's too much. So what I can give you is too much,
mm-hmm.
and you guys can select an hour out of that. So what I ended up delivering was, I don't know, at that point, like 60 or 70 pages.
Right.
Out of which, I don't know, Steph could have used maybe 10 or 20 in an hour.
Yep. Yep.
And then that project got shelved. I don't think he ever produced it.
No, it never
and so
appeared.
What I had said was, because I wanted to do the book, especially after I got started working on it, it was like you could have exclusive rights to it for 3 months to be able to like show your truth about the Rothschilds before I start doing stuff with my book about it.
Right.
And that was fine. And then I think I waited 2 more years before I even started like working seriously, raising funding last year through Indiegogo for the book and the film project that I'm working on.
How did they know to come to you for this?
Probably because when you look at some of the stuff out there that we've produced because of Tragedy and Hope and Cecil Rhodes being funded by the Rothschilds,
right?
That I had video and podcast content out there.
Right. I wonder what the connection was, but that's just me wondering. So let's go back like 11 years. I think that was when I first encountered you. Yours was, I'm almost positive, the first podcast I ever listened to, 9/11 Synchronicity. And it seemed like through a lot of this content, you were not in real time, but it was in real time for the audience trying to re-educate or properly educate yourself on so many things about how the world actually works for the first time after you had, obviously an incredibly bright guy, who had been very successful in school and in higher education. At some point, you come to a conclusion that, the term that you used on 9/11 Synchronicity that stuck with me was you had received a facsimile education or a facsimile of an education.
That comes from the days when they had Xerox machines and
Right.
you could make a facsimile. And then if you kept making copies, that copy it became kind of unreadable and unusable and not a very good representation of the thing it was claiming to be.
Right. Right. So I start with 9/11 Synchronicity because these interviews that are going to take place on this tour, they're very raw, they're very unscripted, and they really are only composed of two topics. The first is your school sucks story, right? When did you realize that this thing you were told was your education was not actually an education? It was a kind of conditioning, a kind of indoctrination. The follow-up to that, which is a
I like
fascinating
the
story.
two-part question.
Yeah, the
Get it
fascinating.
out of the way so you can sit back.
Well, no, because you and I, this is the first, it was very important for me to come here and talk to you first because obviously you've been a kind of mentor, you've been hugely influential, you're a great friend, and this is where I wanted to start. That was very important to me. And through this discussion, we're kind of warning people who are further down the road what my plan is when I put them in front of a microphone.
So, the first thing I would want to mention is that the school sucks moments stop when you start learning for yourself.
Right.
Otherwise, you're going to continue to go through those moments. Life can be a series of school sucks moments, so it's not just one that woke me up. Yeah, I was pretty successful going through college and getting a job in the corporate world, but that had nothing to do with my college education.
Right.
So there's that aspect. So I didn't understand that school sucked because I had filled in my skill set with entrepreneur skills from learning how to pay for college while I was attending,
Right.
which I didn't even do a good job on because, you know, you still had to take out loans back in that time. It wasn't all given to you by the state for free. I don't know how far into the future people listen to this, but when everything's free in the future, people used to pay for stuff in the past. If that doesn't solidify, then people in the future know the value of, you know, doing things for yourself and not getting things for free from government because the more things you get for free, the more dependent you are. So I didn't realize how dependent I was on government education because I was excelling in the corporate world. But that only went on so long because, once you get to the map, you know, that they give you and you compare it to reality and there's things that you're bumping into that aren't on the map. Like, the map says there's a bridge here, but you get there and there's a chasm. You're like, whoa, what's going on?
Right. So much of your
So,
training too is about seeking out authority at that point of confusion, you know?
right. So that led me into, I mean, long story short, becoming a whistleblower because I saw things at work that I knew were illegal. I trained my clients on these laws that were being broken. And it put a lot of other companies at risk, not just clients of my employer, but like at that time, I that's when it's a mandate for every company to have a piece of software, and that software has an alternative purpose, a backdoor, if you will, the ability to carry out the opposite action than what people pay for it for.
People are paying for it as a form of
They were
security.
paying for a prophylactic. It
Yeah.
was a prophylactic with a hole in it
I gotcha.
on purpose.
Right. Right.
That's not the best metaphor, but I think it does communicate. So anyway, I went seeking authority.
Yep.
I blew the whistle under the law. I went through channels, as they say, and you go and you tell, you know, the audit committee of the company, and then you can file a suit and you can do all these different layers of trying to take some action. And then I learned that's not how the world works, that those rules that are in place are really just for some people and other people don't have to follow those rules.
Right.
And so during that process of litigation where I was representing myself pro se, I was the defendant of the company. My former employer was his law firm, and so I was interacting with his law firm, and I was reading a book. I know how dangerous is this. So when I first, so my legal process went on for years, and that was a very educational process that school did not prepare me for.
Mm-hmm.
But having been like a autodidact, I was not a fish out of water. I was like, oh, I could just be my own lawyer. Like I could just read their rules, copy the format from their documents, citations, references, all that stuff. Like that was completely within my capacity without coming from school.
Why did you think you could do that?
Because, I don't know. I never found school challenging. So like from an early age, I was self-educating.
Right.
So by the time I went to school and they're teaching people ABCs and how to write, I'd already asked my dad how to make letters and, you know, how to read words and go into the library before school ever had an assignment for me.
So you had this interest and this ability and this motivation, but what you realize, and when all of this happens with this company.
You want to know why I thought I could do pro se?
Well, when all this happens with this company, yeah. How old are you?
27, maybe.
27. So you've had lots of successes, just teaching yourself up to that point in life. You had been an entrepreneur while you were in college. You had a painting business.
Yeah. And I took the pre-LSAT. I took the P.
Oh, wow.
LSAT, the pre, like a pre-test. So before you go and sit there for the 8 hours on a weekend.
Yeah.
They give out the free pre-test or whatever. And they were having one on the college campus, when I was in school. And I took it just for like, just to see how I do. Right.
Right.
Just cause I thought I might, cause I, at that point, I probably either wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't too serious about either. Because I'd figured out some things about the medical system that would preclude, like, the Hippocratic Oath is no longer in effect, and you're not really able to just help people the way you want to help people with your skills.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the pre-LSAT on a Saturday after a hard night of partying,
mm-hmm.
and I scored in, like, the 99th percentile. Like, 170 out of 172 is the top score.
So this is why you felt you could do?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so I didn't think it was super challenging. I was like, you know, people take that test, they go through and they learn stuff and, you know, so I didn't think that was that challenging. And it isn't. If you read their rule book and you go through the precedents related to the law that you're filing under, it's not as arduous as most people think. I wouldn't recommend it again because like, one thing that's hard to do is when you're representing yourself, it's hard to do objections.
Right. Right.
You just get into answer and question mode. Right. And you should be like, wait a minute, you guys can't do that. Right.
So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So you obviously, you had the aptitude to do this. Yeah. You had the motivation to do this.
I had the law on my side. I had a lot of naivety.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because you're showing that you have all of these self-directed learning skills, but still you went through this public education and higher education where at this point, are you deceived into thinking you're walking into a fair fight?
Absolutely. I thought it was
a
fair fight. If there was evidence of the crime going on and that evidence was legally admissible in court and I had taken it through my management and up through the audit committee and these people all acted irresponsibly.
Right.
Then I thought it was the court's job to keep that corporation in check.
Right. Right.
What I didn't know is like the co-founder of the company was George Bush and Dick Cheney's like largest fundraiser and he became an ambassador to Ireland and stuff like that. And this law firm, to get back to the point I was making. So I'd already learned about the book Tragedy and Hope. I didn't fully comprehend all that Quigley says in that book, but I picked up a couple parts, right? One of the parts I had picked up besides the Rothschilds was J.P. Morgan. Because everyone's just like, in America, J.P. Morgan is like this mythical figure, right?
Yeah, sure.
So anyway, I got Ron Chernow's book, The House of Morgan, which is a great big thick book like this, right? And I'm reading through that book. And at the bottom of a page on the right-hand side, he talks about that J.P. Morgan and company wanted to do some hostile takeover activities and that their white glove law firm of Polk and Wardell, I think it was, wouldn't do these types of corporate activities. So they went to Joe Flom, who's working with Skadden and Arps, who later become Skadden, Arps, Marr, and Flom, which was the attorney that was like my opponent in court.
Mm-hmm.
So EMC, my former company, hired Skadden Arps. Then I'm reading this J.P. Morgan book, and I'm discovering what was the origin of Skadden Arps in the 1950s. So this wasn't J.P. Morgan himself. This is J.P. Morgan, the company, in like the 1950s. Because there's J.P. Morgan, then Jack J.P. Morgan Jr., and then it just becomes the company.
Right.
All referred to the same. That's why he's such a mythical figure in American history, because the guy's name became the son's name, became the company's name, and now it's like J.P. Morgan Chase and whatever, Chase Freedom.
Exactly. Right.
So in House of Morgan, I read about Skadden Arps, and then I was like, well, there's a lot of things going on here that I'm not taught about in school.
Right.
Just as far as the interrelationship of government and finance and these lawyers. So then I looked up the lawyers on like Wikipedia or whatever. And I was like, who's their clients? Oh, when the government got in trouble with Iran-Contra, they called Skadden Arps. When they had BCCI, drug money laundering, CIA connection trouble, they called Skadden Arps, right? These dudes are like the government's law firm. One of many, but it's the biggest law firm in America. It's one of the biggest law firms in the world. It's multi-billion dollar law firm. And I was going up against them like David versus Goliath. He was a
absolutely
biblical metaphor.
So this is trial by fire, and you discover this as you've already decided to go through with these proceedings.
Well, I knew not to get too deep into all this, but right before the trial started, they had a pretrial meeting. They called me into this room and they offered me a settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And right there, when they offered me a settlement, I was like, that 30 boxes of documents they just brought into the room, that's all bullshit.
Right.
Right. That's a scare tactic. These dudes were huge. The shortest guy was like 6'6", and the other guy was like 6'8".
Mm-hmm.
Huge guys, towering figures, right? So their whole thing was to be intimidating and then make an offer. And I was like, if you're making this offer, that means, you know, I have evidence and I'm going to win. So I said no to the offer, and I went through 3 days of trial. And I got all the evidence I needed on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't able to refute it. And at one point the judge says, because I kept trying to introduce more evidence, and he's like, your testimony stands the day. They can't refute it. They're not refuting it. You already called their witnesses as your witnesses, because I read a rule in a book. They freaked out when I did this. So there's a rule in the book that says if the opposition's witnesses are in the room, you can call them as your witnesses. And so I think at the end of day one, when they said, if you're done with your testimony tomorrow, they're going to do cross-examination. I said, no, I have two witnesses, Your Honor. And they said, they're not on the schedule. I said, they're right here in the room. And they said, you can't do that. And I said, Judge, I read in the rules that if the witnesses are in the room, you can call them as your witnesses. He said, you're right. He said, tomorrow morning we'll start. You can do direct examination of them.
Mm.
Right? So it's not an impossible situation on the face of it. But if the underlying game is rigged such
right.
that you can do whatever in court, and then they wait 9 months and they're like, whatever. Here's what we're saying. You know, it's outside of the statute of limitations, and, you know, your claims are invalid.
You know? Okay. So in saying that you don't even have a basis to make these claims?
Well,
or...
I could appeal it. Well, no, first off, it's proven in trial that I had a basis to make the claims, because I went through methodically and they were able to either say, you know, no, judge, and then I was able to overcome their objection, or they didn't have an objection.
Right.
Right. So when you see the judge like shaking hands with them and their witnesses in the hallway, and they got these big rings on and stuff, like one of the guys who was on the defense, one of the management, like, these are ex NFL football players. They had no business. They had no skill set to be executives at a software company doing what they're doing. Right. And so when you see these guys are like glad handing and like talking very closely in the hall, and I'm not part of those conversations. And they don't, like, separately, the judge wasn't coming over to me and be like, hey, well, let me see your ring. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
There was something else going on there. And the judge that came into Hartford was from Boston, and Skadden Arps is based out of Boston. So right then, it's like, you know, I'm not going to, like, cry over spilled milk, and I wasn't going to continue to appeal it. Like, I learned my lesson.
Right.
That whole process from thinking that you could blow the whistle to thinking that they're going to do something to thinking that the press is going to cover, you know, a multi-billion dollar company ripping off all these other companies across America, like the effects of this that would have on the stock market and stuff like that. And so instead, what you had was all these companies mandated to have the software, and then one of the biggest financial crashes in American history. And there's no records of the emails that went on between these executives and these subprime mortgages, because that's all gone.
Right.
That's supposed to be part of Sarbanes-Oxley. Just like Hillary Clinton's, all those emails that are missing, mm-hmm. George Bush's emails that are missing, that's all supposed to be covered under Sarbanes-Oxley. So it's like there are government Rhodes Scholar mandated, because Paul Sarbanes was a Rhodes Scholar. Mm-hmm. So we have like Rhodes Scholar mandated laws in this country to protect against this fraud, and it's actually used to perpetrate fraud. And it's like Grand Theft World.
Now,
through that process, there's a series of school sucks moments in there. But you have, like, you come to a point where there's a fork in the road, and you can go back to the corporate world.
Yeah.
And to go back, you shouldn't be a whistleblower in the first place.
Right.
So if you're going to try to go back, now you're going to have to learn a new career. Or you can pursue this whole other path that no one even told you was there, that has all these interesting artifacts so far. And it seems like if these people have such substantial influence so as to save national banks, like J.P. Morgan was called in to save the country because the country was broke in 1908, right?
Right.
That's why they ended up bringing out the Federal Reserve. And there's several instances in Britain's history where the Rothschilds came in and saved Wellington, like twice. They saved the Bank of England. They bought the Royal Mint Refinery. Like, there's all these things that I think play a substantial role in history, and we're not taught about any of that. So from an entrepreneurial aspect, there's a public need. And I observe that, and I could say, well, somebody should do that. Or I could say, oh, I have the skills and acumen to do that. I could repurpose my skill set of, you know, communication and strategic thinking and analytical reading from working for a corporation that's selling hardware to, like, defense contractors, the banks that rip people off. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't, like, a really fulfilling anything. So on any given day, being an entrepreneur, working for myself, I find it more fulfilling than any of those days.
Right. So I think just the reason why I wanted you to start with this court story is that it almost feels unfair to me to pin it on being a failure of school.
I wouldn't say that part was a failure.
No,
that's
what
I'm
saying.
That's just a failure of everybody, like nobody around me, like my parents, my friends, nobody had that bigger picture.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's no way could have that specific bigger picture.
Right.
What I think is interesting about what you've done since you had that experience in a variety of different forms, starting in a more raw and probably unfinished type of form with 9/11 synchronicity and then moving on to tragedy and hope.
Yeah, that was more saying there's a bunch of things off the map.
Right. So
then I got more specific about, hey, there's a specific pattern here that's relevant and substantial. So that's what Peace Revolution is.
That's what I thought was interesting, is that you wound up as a young man in a situation that no form of education could probably prepare someone to thrive in. I mean, you were
Ivy
set
League
up to
probably
fail.
Would have taught you to do something else in that situation instead of saying, hey, this is wrong. They'd be like, no, this is how stuff works. Those families all come from the opium smuggling, privateering, right? So there's a whole different code of ethics. That's why when I said, hey, this is wrong, some of these people were like, dude, you should just shut up and go along with this. This is like how real money's made.
Right, right.
You know?
But then what you tried to do, unprepared, realizing you had been unprepared for that specific situation, is step back and try to actually develop, not just make a map, but develop the tools for map making to survive situations that are similar to that in the future.
Right.
And to help other people, to make those skills like transportable for other people to do that too.
Yeah, it's a form of cartography.
Yeah.
Same thing that they used to do, like, you know, several hundred years ago when they found out that there was stuff they didn't know about, then they're trying to figure out, what is it? How far does it go? You know, how do we get around it? How do we navigate? And that's the same thing today, but no one's even being told that there's anything outside of the map.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
So,
because the way they have media set up to, like, if you go to YouTube or any of these places without searching, look at what they show you. Right, left paradigm, fluffy cats playing with yarn. Some dude hitting himself in the balls. Those are like the four choices, and they're going to keep you in that box. But if you start asking questions like, is the Journal of Jean Lafitte real? Or, you know, any of these things that are like, there's historical documents and they have very interesting things in them. And no one's ever going to tell you about that document because there's too many interesting things in there that could be actual. And if it's a forgery, then, you know, somebody should probably prove that. But until it's put on your map, you have no idea why you might be interested in that.
How do you look back at, well, all that being said, the cartography of 9/11 synchronicity and the first thing you ever put out there that I knew about anyway, it was called Project Constellation, where you tried to connect the dots between all of these pieces around 9/11. How do you relate that to the work you do today? I ask because, like, I didn't know you when you did 9/11 synchronicity.
Yeah.
You were just a stranger on the internet. I didn't meet you. I sent you an email at the end of 2006, and I said, I think what you're doing is interesting. Like, it had been that affected. I'd been that affected by it that I thought I could email a stranger and get a response. And you wrote back and said, you were polite and said, let's talk after Christmas. And we didn't talk until after Christmas, like, you know, it was 3 or 4 years later that we met.
Sure.
My assessment of you as a stranger was like, I see somebody like trying to make a map, but I don't really, I didn't think you knew.
I didn't think it was my job to make a map at that point.
But you were asking questions and you were trying to like get, maybe you weren't going to be able to say, here, look, I made this accurate map, but you were trying to survey as much as you possibly could. You were trying to collect as much data as you.
So basically what I say is I'm seeing things that aren't on a map.
Right.
Are you guys seeing these things? And if so, has anyone made a map? You guys should make a map. So my recommendation was like, those guys at Loose Change should do something. Right. So basically it was, it starts out with, in my case, personal experiences plus listening. But for a lot of people, it just starts out with listening to a bunch of different media. And then you start to have like, questions or things that you think should be in there. Like, I don't like the way Alex Jones does this. Well, you get to a point where instead of not liking that, say, I'm going to be the change. I'm going to fill that void right there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's opportunity to be able to add something and complement something instead of trying to tear stuff down. Right.
Right.
So in my case, I was trying to say, hey, you guys should, if you're talking about 9/11, you should consider these points about AIG and Marsh and Kroll and all these other, corporate affiliations that are very close to the intelligence agencies, which are also very close to the people who own the properties and insured the properties and all this sort of stuff. Right. So I was kind of like, hey, you guys should do a better job. But then Maria Heller was like, hey, I want to publish this. And I was like, wow, it wasn't really for publishing. It was like a message to people. It was like instead of writing a letter,
right,
you know, typing a bunch of pages, I thought it'd be more compelling and easier for people to consume if I just made an MP3 version, right?
Because you were sending this to everybody, like
a digital asset.
Yeah.
Right. So I thought naively at the time that there were people out there like adults. You know how Joe Rogan has that joke about adults and he's like, one day you're at the store and somebody calls you sir and you're like, holy shit, I'm an adult. Like there's nobody responsible around. Like nobody knows what the fuck's going on.
Right. Right. Right?
So at one point I was like, well, who are the people who are authority figures who might not be involved with these angles of being involved with these corporations, right? So I don't know. I sent 100 of those packages out.
To famous people and influential people, right?
To anybody and everybody that I thought might have a platform. Because there was no social media back then.
Right.
You had the internet, but who has the platform to get on some show and say, hey, you guys should check this out, right?
Right.
And you knew that like MSNBC or CNN's not going to talk about it. And so what's the alternative landscape? You had Alex Jones, who's like the 800-pound gorilla. That's a IT industry term, mm-hmm. 800-pound gorilla. Like mm-hmm. IBM would be the 800-pound gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a bunch of little, you know, advertised shows on these little disparate radio networks. So I was just like, you know, send packages to people who...
In the mail, yeah. Yeah.
People who might have some influence, like a reach on a platform, you know? Mm-hmm. I sent a package one time to Larry Flint because I saw that movie about Larry Flint, right? And then you're like, oh, this guy's a publisher. And yeah, he was publishing porn, but there was also articles that got put out through his magazine that never would have seen the light of day.
Right.
So I sent him a package and it's like, hey, here's all these points about 9/11. You guys should talk about this. I even sent him to his brother because in the movie he referenced his brother. So I was like, oh, who's his brother? And I sent the package, right? So then I got a letter back from their attorneys. Cease and desist, right? And they're like, they cite the, like, here's the title. We, you know, this whole thing. Because they also, the reason I wrote to him is because he had a lawsuit against Rumsfeld active at the time. And I was like, dude, if you have a lawsuit already against Rumsfeld and these other guys, you should consider this information, right? So I got a cease and desist letter. And then 2 years later, they published an article about 9/11, right? I think it was a David Ray Griffin article, which I thought was like, it's not the best, but at least you guys are saying something about it because it seems like everybody else was on the take to say nothing about it except the official story. And when you compare the official story to the actual facts, they don't correlate very well.
Did you ever at any point, well, let me ask you this first and then I'll ask this follow-up question. Was there anyone you were particularly disappointed to not get a response from? Someone you thought, like, this person is really going to...
Alex Jones, dude.
Yeah.
Because you find out later, because when I was actually at InfoWars in 2013 with the crew from State of Mind.
Right.
You find out mail doesn't even go to the place where he works every day. They have a whole other warehouse across the street where mail and packages and stuff like that goes. So, like, you could send Alex Jones a bar of gold, and he's probably not going to get it. I'm not saying to do that. I'm just saying, like, you could send him something valuable that he would probably want. And
right.
It's not going to make it to him. Just because that operation, and this was years ago before they even did any expansion. Like, before they started having all their own everything, and they still had, like, GCN advertising, and that was their model, There was like, he had 50 people down there and huge, and he was building the studio that they use now, and then they are building another studio or two.
So there's many gates and their keepers, right, between this message that you have. And it's not just the logistics of getting that to somebody. It's also like, say it does wind up in somebody's hands. There was you at this time, there was you, and then there was the young guy who made the Who Killed John O'Neill movie. What was his name?
It was Ryan Thurston and Ty Rober.
Ty Rober.
Yeah.
Who came on the podcast. If you try to, like, even as a film.
Can I hear a funny story real quick about him trying to get a message to Alex Jones?
The only thing is that I want to say is, even if you were Ty Rober, took your Project Constellation or this movie that he made that sort of followed a very similar map, Who Killed John O'Neill, even to Alex Jones, it's like, well, wait a minute, this is off the map that I have. Now, if you send it to like Harrison Ford or Larry Flint, they'd be like, what, this doesn't even compute. This isn't even this planet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's no context to make sense of that.
What you discover, the whole part of the school sucks, moment.
Right.
Is there is an information gap.
Yeah.
And that information gap is a knowledge gap, and that becomes a power gap.
Right.
And that's the difference between the people that rule and the people that are getting ruled. And to close that gap, we do something called learning. We can consume media. We can create media. We can help other people together to build a bridge, or you can build a bridge. Like if my book is doing something, it's building a bridge in a place where I think there should be a bridge, but no one has built a reliable bridge. There's a lot of people that have like one of those string bridges that go across this, like with the rickety boards and stuff like that.
Right.
And I'm like, the materials are available to build a bridge that is not going to be broken.
Right.
So like you'll be able to cross it with ease and confidence instead of being like, cause a lot of, if I can finish the metaphor, the rickety string bridge is somebody telling you a story about the Rothschilds with no footnotes, no primary sources. It's like, you're left to believe them. That may actually reflect the facts, but you have to do a whole bunch of research to figure that out. I think it's the author's job in a properly written book to help provide the tools so you can have the confidence when you read the statement, read the source, and it's all right there, that you can make a judgment to, do I think that's a reliable source? You know?
Yeah.
Cause if you put it at the end notes, you got to wait to the end and then it's all out of context, or even worse, at the end of the book instead of the end of the chapter. Then you're flipping back and forth all the time. So I specifically tried to write my book differently because I think most books are written in a poor format. I know that's kind of arrogant, but I wanted my book to reflect a learning process, and the learning process is written and conveyed in a different fashion than most books are. For instance, Harvard professor Neil Ferguson, it's spelled Niall, but his name's Neil, wrote a 2-volume set on the Rothschilds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, Rich, there's this Neil Ferguson 2-volume set, you know, this whole history of the Rothschilds.
Right.
And it's not good enough for me. I have, cause he spent so much time with the direct papers, he doesn't have hardly any footnotes in there. So when he gives me a fact about, you know, Solomon de Rothschild's trip to America during the American Civil War, I want to know what was the date of the letter that he wrote that in. Like, I have Solomon's letters. I want to make these connections. And so because he's an official family biographer, he doesn't have the need to footnote everything. Whereas I, in my book, every declarative statement, especially if it's mine, will have a footnote. So every quote has a footnote, and anything that I'm making a factual statement about will have a footnote where I got those facts. Because otherwise, the traditional way of writing is you read all this stuff and then you put it in your own words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a layer of abstraction that I don't feel is necessary. Why does it have to go from the Nathan Rothschild said this in a letter to my own words? Now you have to interpret that. You don't know what he said in his entirety, right?
Right, right.
So,
I do my best to
harvest the quotes that are out there. And so it's a compendium.
Uh-huh.
It's a collection of artifacts and resources set up in a chronological manner, set up in a chronological, timeline.
Okay. So you and, was it Neil Ferguson?
Neil Ferguson.
Are writing with different, this about the same subject, with different purposes. Is that fair to say? So,
because I think there's a lot of history being left out of everything that's been written. So I've read all the stuff that's existing, and I'm saying kind of here's what's missing, and here's how to put it together. And sometimes I refer you back to these books, but a lot of times I'm telling you the story that they're leaving out.
How would you compare your purposes? Like, what do you think his goals were? Why did he
want to tell that story? This is more of marketing and advertisement and branding.
Yeah.
Modern branding. And, I think there's just there's some key facts that are left out of it that are in the Rothschild archives. So, like, all my source material is, like, how would you want to, do you want to use stock rating? It's like AAA.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing subpar. Like, you read through the bibliography and you're not going to find Henry Macau. You're not going to find an internet site that's not the Rothschild Archive London or someplace that has actual source materials.
Right. So we had this thing, like, just to change from, you know, one topic to another, the book in the 1970s by, who was it, Gary Allen, Nundeer called it Conspiracy. So this guy wrote this book with a purpose in mind, right?
His son started Politico.
Interesting. No, I didn't know that. But you talk about having different purposes, and you talk about working from, like, official source materials and this thing where you have to read something and then interpret it, and then you put it into your own words, which is informed by what your purpose is for doing that. So we have this story about, I guess, the Anglo-American establishment that comes from this guy in the 1970s, and he writes the book with an agenda, and then people read that book, and then they take his words that are interpretations of, official sources. And just as we go on, it's like the education itself, the copy gets duller.
Right.
Yeah.
So I like to keep it, I want to write as little as possible in the book. Really what I want to give is context for the chronological segments of passages from various books. So there's contradictions, but those contradictions come from, Solomon Rothschild said it this way, Lionel Rothschild said it this way, and Nathan Rothschild said it this way. Well, to me, that's how you learn. You read these different accounts and you're like, oh, well, you know, maybe they weren't all in agreement on that topic. Right.
Right.
So it's not my job to like try to prove a point. My only point is, my only argument in the book is that the Rothschild family, starting with Meyer Amschel Rothschild and his five sons who created international banks, have played a substantial role in world history, especially Western history. And nobody in America, Britain, or India, as far as school children, are taught about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other topics that all three of these populations also aren't taught about. And those topics do interrelate. So I also find that interesting, but I don't make a causal argument like, oh, it's all suppressed because I'm just saying, once you see what is, you don't have to make accusations because you're just like, oh, this is how history is really developed. Mm. And it really helps to fill in a bunch of the blanks in our own understanding.
Yeah. There's something dangerous as time goes on about this idea that, you know, has existed in the schools for a long time, that the average person doesn't need to know about these people or what they do or how they do what they do.
Yeah. So I'm going to actually, when I write, I have notes for the preface, because I want to write that when I'm done writing everything else. But one of the notes is to reference Quigley's quote from Tragedy and Hope. I think it's on page 960, where he's like, I have no aversion to this, because he's like, here's what's going on in reality.
Mm-hmm.
I have no aversion to this. I think only that it should be known. Well, that's really what his aversion is, that he thinks, you know, that he said these people want to keep it secret and I think it should be public.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He doesn't have to be averse to reality, like, because that's how reality works. But if people knew about this, reality would work differently. In other words, he's saying they can only do all this stuff under the guise of secrecy. They can't do it overtly. It's very hard for them to do it overtly because then you have people recognize the overtness of state and authority monopoly on violence.
It is interesting, and because it just seems like something that people could be readjusted for, accepting. People are willing to accept a lot that is overt through how they're educated in secondary school, in college. It's like, it's just an interesting question to how are these limits decided? Like, this would be too much for people to know about.
Public opinion, government, that's what politics is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if they told you that they were going over and killing people so that they can monopolize opium production in Afghanistan and take natural resources, people would be horrified by that. But if we're going over there under some other guise to, you know, preserve liberty and defend freedom, then everybody's like, rah, rah for that.
Right.
So that's always the guise of the difference between the actions of the rulers and the politics. The politics are what they say to get that stuff done.
The reason why I made that point, though, is because, like, everybody knows who the Rockefellers are, right? They're an open part of American history.
Yeah. And they weren't even wealthy in comparison.
But I might not have ever heard about the Rothschild family until I watched some conspiracy video on Google Video in 2005 or 2006.
That's a school sucks moment right there. Because,
but is it?
Absolutely.
Would any education be really, any form of education, public or private or, you know, self-directed, any
school?
Well,
how about this?
Okay.
When you look up Rothschild in a modern encyclopedia, and then you look up Rothschild in a 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica or a 1906 Jewish Encyclopedia, the guys that wrote Jewish Encyclopedia actually went to the Rothschilds first because they thought they would pay to publish it.
Right.
Right. So there's very different descriptions before World War I and World War II. And then, so it was somewhat on the radar because you can look in, various publications from like the 1830s in America, 1829, 1835. There were articles talking about how Lord Rothschild has cut a deal with the Sultan of Turkey to take Palestine.
Right.
Well, that's over 100 years before Israel was even created. That's
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you might learn something about the Rothschild's involvement in Israel online, it's probably going to be in an inaccurate kind of derogatory manner that has some sort of agenda to it instead of just stating the facts. But if you were just taught the facts that the area has been under colonization for like 100 years before Israel was created, then if that's the history and they're not doing anything wrong, then there shouldn't be any problem with, you know, teaching that, right? Why is that part hidden? I think it's hidden from a lot of people. And they're like, no, nothing happened with that until the Balfour Declaration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Balfour Declaration itself. The first draft of it was written to Lord Rothschild. The end draft of it was written to Lord Rothschild, or the first draft of it was written by Lord Rothschild. The end draft is addressed to him, right? So isn't that an interesting piece of history? The Balfour Declaration is a very interesting piece of history because this is the 100-year anniversary, and there's a website, and you can see all the different drafts. And the other guys that participated in the drafts were all acolytes of Cecil Rhodes. And
this is about the creation of Israel, for people who don't know?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, that's where the British Empire had a mandate over Palestine, and after World War One, they designated it to the Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
So the Balfour Declaration is a letter from Arthur Balfour on behalf of the British government in on November 2nd, 1917, addressed to Lord Rothschild on behalf of like the British Zionists, and it says that they're going to give them Palestine. So you see that, and you're like, well, that's the origin of what became Israel. But there was like 100 years worth of work before they even had that letter. And then when you do the research on the letter was initiated by Lord Rothschild. He's like, here's what I'd like. And then it goes through a couple revisions, and then they send it back to him as like this official address.
Yep.
Yeah. So
it's interesting.
Peace in the Middle East starts with learning the history of what's going on there.
One of the things that I did when I first started to learn about when I was exposed to the fact that the Rothschild family existed, even. I did this with several things that I was learning about, like 2005, 2006. I still had my college textbooks, Western Civ 2.
Sure.
And you go through the index, and these things aren't even, you'd be shocked with the things that aren't even mentioned, even though they're so intertwined with things like the Balfour Declaration that is mentioned.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, those things, that's an example of new criticism, where they remove the historical context from the facts they're teaching you,
mm-hmm.
right? Because even if you just use Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is made up of the footnotes and sources at the bottom of each article.
Mm-hmm.
So you read an article, and if you see something that's footnoted, you click and you see what the source is, and you look that source up, and you start reading from there so you can get the context, right?
Right.
So even today, if you read the article on either the Rothschild family or just type in Rothschild on Wikipedia, you're going to have a whole bunch of information from a variety of sources available to you. And then you can see just how legitimate it is. Like the whole side, if you go down the whole page of the Rothschild family, there's like 30 different mansions that are just more grandiose than anything the Rockefellers ever had, or anything the Vanderbilts built.
Right.
Right.
One's used in Eyes Wide Shut, I believe.
Okay. So, Eyes Wide Shut uses Mentmore Towers, which is a Rothschild castle. So like Bruce Wayne's Wayne Manor and
mm-hmm.
Batman Begins in 2005 or whatever, mm-hmm. Christopher Nolan. Wayne Manor is a Rothschild castle, Mentmore,
mm-hmm.
Mentmore Castle. So if you just look down at their properties in all these different countries, there was no wealthy robber baron in America who had anywhere near that type of amalgamated wealth. And the wealth is simply through their cooperation as, you know, five brothers in five different countries. And that enabled governments to do business with each other more readily. So they're not like lending to the average people. So somebody said, hey, show me a Rothschild on the banks in America. I'm like, you're thinking too small. Like the dudes who start, like Rockefeller started with oil and moved into banking. Mm-hmm. Rothschild started with banking and moved into oil. They ran the Nobel monopoly. So the Nobel brothers had a Rockefeller. They were the Rockefellers of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We're not taught about them at all. So we just think Rockefellers, they were running everything. Well, no, the Nobels and the Rothschilds had a monopoly, and then they merged like 1895. And then they formed Royal Dutch Shell, which still exists today. Right. So you're talking about the level of financing countries, not financing businesses in America. Although there's a ton of funding that they executed in America through their agent, August Belmont, who had grown up working in their shop from like age 13 in Germany, was sent over here. And then he was their official agent to invest in railroads and all sorts of infrastructure projects of the 1800s. So it's there. You just need to know how it's registered. Or like what companies they were using. But again, like who funded the New York subway? The Interborough Rapid Transit Company.
There's always
August Belmont. Yeah. And then when he got in trouble, the Rothschilds themselves came in and bailed him out like 1907. And they say, there's all these cool quotes about how they came in and bailed out. They're like, oh, we had to go in and get August. He got in over his head, you know? And I just think it's such a, I don't know. It's like leaving a color out of the spectrum, right? They're showing you, here's a spectrum of color that represents the history of our country, but they're like leaving out the color, you know, red or green or yellow. That's just like a gray area.
Well,
like, don't try to fill in that gray area.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you lose a ton of causality. You don't understand motives and it almost seems like things happen by destiny and not by design.
How much time do we have left? Cause I also wanted to, the other school sucks moment, cause there's upsides to it too. It's not all just downsides. The school sucks. Moment that Brett's going to be asking everybody about across the country as he goes to California has to do with what you do once you recognize those school sucks moments.
Indeed. Right? And we talked about that a little, but I'd be happy to expand on it.
Well, as far as not feeling, because I think a lot of people, they get to that part where like, oh, education failed me. And then they just take a, like a victim mentality, not because they're victims, but because they haven't been presented with any other options. So this is where teaching skills of entrepreneurism would come in. And it's an opportunity I only had because I answered a newspaper ad in college while I was trying to like, you know, make some money to pay rent.
Right. Well, I think there's something to be
about, like once you realize that the system's not that like the path that's paved is not the path that leads you where you want to go. It's being able to step on like, oh, well, I'm going to answer this ad in a paper. That sounds interesting. And it was a whole skill set that was the only causal function of me being very successful in corporate world. Because if I hadn't learned how to do sales, like just learning that one skill, which I think everybody should have because everybody buys something.
Right.
And every product has to be sold. Like this is a basic function of just self-reliance, not even just capitalism. It's just like, you know, you need to be able to observe and create. This is like creativity. Like you can create a new tool. If you were living in the woods and this is pre-civilization, you would still be carrying out this process. You might convince somebody else, hey, I made some extra of these tools. Can I trade you this tool for some of that food? Right? Check this out. You can.
So is this a skill that you just felt like you could take to the next place with you? Because like when you left New York City, what was that, 2002, 2003? When I first encountered you, you were in some ways kind of run out of that city. You were intimidated in certain ways. Somebody threatened to pay you off in a hospital after you had to have a surgery. Like that's all part of this story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, what I thought was interesting, and one of the things that I think kept me listening to 9/11 synchronicity is that I could tell you were somebody, like you were affected by what had happened over the previous 5 years, but you weren't afraid to confront all of this stuff. And you weren't afraid to confront and call out all of these people, even though it seemed like what you described over the course of a couple of years was a plan targeted at you, designed to make you run away with your tail between your legs. So I wonder if having that, like, I know I can take this skill of sales, which isn't just about products, but also about ideas and information and about oneself, and move it into something else, which is what you seem to do when I first encountered
you. Well, sales is just about helping people solve problems. You do that through asking questions and listening and then trying to help them think through the steps that lead to the solution.
Right.
Right. Sometimes it's a product, sometimes it's a service. But having an understanding of a skill set that where you, the world turns into opportunity. Like, for example, I had a home improvement and painting business in college. That was part of my entrepreneurial experience. When you drive down the street and you're in that line of business, you see this house, this house, this house,
exactly.
this house.
Exactly.
There's money all up and down the street. All I have to do is go up, start having a conversation, and find out what their objection is. I don't have enough money. We just had it painted. All these things. And so it's just a process. And you can walk up to any of those houses and close a deal by, you know, sunset, and you'll have a house to paint the next day, right? So there's like that knowledge of there's money out there. There's people that have the need for my service. All I have to do is go and talk to them and have a conversation. And if I do that, if I collect enough no's, so my tip is always to send people out and go fail 10 times. Go collect 10 no's tonight on your service or product or whatever you're trying to sell. Right? Because in the process of actually doing that, you're going to succeed. Somebody's going to be like, yeah, I actually do need my house painted and I have $1,000. I can do that and we can do it tomorrow. Great. Right? So just in the process, if you're willing to, like, if you make it that goal, then you're okay either way. I went out and failed 10 times tonight. I met my goal. I went out and failed 8 times and I closed 2 sales. I still met my goal.
Right.
So there's that. So I call that bootstrapping. Like, you're really just trying to get yourself started and you go through a set of actions. It's like trial and error with a happy face. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's a skill set. So once you know that you have a bunch of those skill sets, right? So it doesn't have to be a house that needs to be painted. It could be somebody with copywriting on their website that's written by developers and not written from the customer's advantage. Right. I can immediately add value, show how I could add value, and then we can set up a consulting relationship. So when you have a skill set like that, you're not afraid of losing your job or like, oh, I'm not going to do the right thing because I need this comfy job or I'm going to lose my pension. You're more like, you're perturbed by these people that are doing the wrong thing. You're like, I'm willing to take a couple steps out of my way to, mm-hmm. to do something about that. So from the perspective of if my whistleblowing leads to me not having a career, that was no big deal. But I also didn't know, hey, by the way, you're going to need to spend 10 years reading a bunch of books to figure out and fill in this blind spot that you just bumped into. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that was like the unplanned part. But that's also the most rewarding part because I've learned more since I retired from the corporate world than I ever did in school, than I ever did on any of my corporate jobs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it's such a Prussian authoritarian mentality of you only need to do this to do, like, there's no comprehensive or free flow of learning or natural flow of learning at all. It's all that interrupted, you learn this till this time and then move on and do this. And it's like,
right.
That's not how water flows, man.
When you left New York, did you ever think you were going to have to go back to that world, to the corporate world, or did you never look back?
It wasn't realistic for me to try to go get a job in that industry in that part of the country within a couple, like while I still had a lawsuit going on.
Most, right.
Because that's going to be, I'm not going to go through an interview and not be like, hey, I have a lawsuit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when I filed the paperwork, when I sent the email on November 4th, 2003, I was okay with burning that bridge and never working in corporate software enterprise sales.
Right.
I could still do sales or marketing at some other company, but my industry where I had contacts and customers in New York City and all these companies, like you can, what people do is you're a sales rep with a set of relationships in a territory. When you go to another company, you're bringing those to that other company. So there's a certain amount of value in that relationship, but I was willing to say, I don't need any of that.
Right.
Like I wasn't scared to be like, so if you don't do something, you could just go work at another company, have those same clients, no problem, whatever, if you're willing to. But, yeah, there's too much downside to it. Like when people are, as you raise awareness to what's going on and the illegal nature of it,
mm-hmm.
Retaliation will start.
Yep. Yeah.
Certain accounts will start doing business and it's like, hey, this was an order and your name's on it and it went to Northrop Grumman. And then you have to go about proving that that's not my order. I had nothing to do with that. And then the other guy, you know, so there's like a whole bunch of dirty trick squad that start because they want to apply resistance. They want you to like be obedient and comply.
Absolutely.
And most people, and they're surprised when you don't. It's like, dude, you're going to give up your career. Like, you know, like, why are you, like, one of the quotes was, you know, hey, you could talk about this. Just don't talk about it outside the group. Like, why are you like a tenor at the top? Like, why are you screaming like a tenor at the top of the Empire State Building? Like, why are you telling people outside of this group that this is going, like, that's none of their business, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're in a publicly traded company that's getting bought by another company for a couple $1 billion, and you're asking me to forge sales numbers so that they can raise the price and all this crap? It's like, no, dude, if you participate in that, you could get hung out to dry, and the people that get hung out to dry are not the people doing it. They're always doing it to people below. So you really have to have a CYA mentality. And when they, like, for instance, If there's a law in place like Sarbanes-Oxley that says they're going to keep all the emails, all of a sudden the email, like, you don't get those instructions via email now. You get them on the cell phone.
Right.
Your boss sends you an email, tells you to do one thing, then calls you on a cell phone, tells you to do another thing. Well, I just had to put that so it's in the record. But really what I want you to do is, like, I'm like, that's bullshit. Right. So yeah. I was indignant. That's the word I was looking for. I was like, this, you know. I was raised in a part of the world where organized crime and its relationship to government and business was not made clear to me. I thought maybe the Godfather was just like, oh, they're just making the mafia up.
Right. Well, I mean, and that indignance is that, I think that was my initial attraction to your work,
Country
right?
Country boy goes to city.
Well, that was it. I mean,
it went wrong.
It was that kind of, it was that kind of thing.
Well, I told my parents, I was like, hey, there's an upside of being raised in a community with a bunch of, like, honest, hardworking people that all got along. And it was good because I was raised in a small town and there's a lot of family and friends for many generations. So everybody knows everybody. But there's also a problem with that. When you come from a place where not everyone's like, trying to give you the shaft, and you move to New York City, and on any given moment, you could be dealing with an honest person, a very dishonest person, a con man, you know, or other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Like I said, naivete, that's part of the school sucks moment experience.
Maybe that was still part of you then, too, when you started doing that, because I remember listening. I never encountered any, like, a regular person who was clearly a regular person in real life taking on something so powerful. In real time.
Yeah.
Like, this fight was still going on for you and Lisa when you started doing that show. So it was almost like the episodes, the next revelation in the next
year,
show couldn't come fast enough.
Yeah, my next case, my case wasn't over till like 2007. So it was like a year of 9/11 synchronicity probably before, or even maybe a little bit later. And I think hers was done in 2006 at some point. I'd have to check. It's been so long now.
There was an indignance about it that I thought was interesting because it was almost like, I was watching like a movie unfold, but I wasn't even sure that you were the protagonist because I was like, this guy could be crazy. This guy could be just, you know, bitter about what's done. This could not even be real. I mean, like, all these things went through my head.
Yeah.
And so over time, then when I actually get to know you and I've actually seen some of this stuff, like the files from this still exist in this house. I mean, it's amazing.
If I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have gone along with it. But I don't know that I would have taken the legal process. I probably just would have walked away because I would have had enough experience. Like, I'm not going to participate, but I also know that if I try to apply authority, you guys are the authority.
Right.
This is how shit has worked for a long time.
The first hidden lesson of school.
So, but
I mean, that's what got you, isn't it?
But then I'm able to walk away and be an entrepreneur and do things that give me a lot of, enjoyment.
Yeah.
As opposed to like going into a corporate presentation on how we're going to help your web infrastructure and sell you servers and all that stuff I used to do. Like, it paid a lot of good money, dude. I won't, like, you know, I think the best year I had, I made like $270,000 and I only worked 7 months that year.
Yeah.
Right. So that was like, it wasn't manual labor. That was good money. It's good money for anybody.
Right.
Right. But there's a price to that. And the price was I wasn't doing anything meaningful or substantial or interesting or, where I felt I had to really apply myself or any skills to help anybody else. You know, you're helping these other corporations. They don't even really like that. You know, you're not helping people. Yeah. So people working those jobs, but ultimately you're helping to achieve the aims of Goldman Sachs, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, all these other companies that were my clients that I was selling software to. I'm like, I'm just helping them do their war machine better. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of my clients was DynCorp. So I'm going through my case and they're doing human trafficking and they have contracts with the Pentagon. And by the time Cynthia McKinney calls them out on the whole thing, they're just like, oh, I don't know. Right. So I don't know. There was too much I was finding that was not on my map. And I said, I need a better map. And then along the way, I was like, hey, maybe other people need a better map too. Maybe I can make some sort of model of what I'm finding so that they can find what's going on more readily.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the history blueprint.
And we got the brain out of that. Yeah. Absolutely. That when, if people are new to you listening to this, they should definitely go back and search my show's archives for Richard Grove. We did a tutorial on how to set up the brain. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It would be very, very difficult to create the curriculum you've created without having the very specific experiences you've had, right. You know, but you've given people the broader tools to make meaning and understanding out of their own experiences, you know, that are different from yours.
Like, right, because I just try to show, like, as I'm finding stuff, hey, here's what I'm finding, here's where I'm finding it. And then I kind of expect people who listen to the podcast, they'll listen to it, and then they'll dig in, then they'll find stuff I haven't found yet.
Right.
So it's like sharing your exercise routine. Like, I find this exercise routine of learning stuff to be healthy for
absolutely
my mind,
right,
and builds a longer attention span, and I'm able to remember more because I put it in the history blueprint. So my recollection of facts that I've studied, first, there's the confidence knowing that I can just type in the word and find anything I've researched in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that allows my brain to more readily store as I'm entering it in and connecting these things together. You're like building neuron connections in your mind as well.
Indeed.
Right. So I created the tool so I could learn more readily and have better effective recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made that tool shareable. And then I made it so that people can buy it for themselves and have it without using the internet.
Well, that was one of the stories that I wanted you to tell on this show, and I appreciate you being the first interview in School Sucks Across America.
I'm sorry we don't have more time. Up against your hard limit, you said that you wanted to get out by like 1.
Right.
The last thing I would have to offer then to close it out would be, once you figure out your school sucks moment and that, you know, there might be places you want to go in the world and the education you've got won't take you there, learn how to learn anything for yourself. Most importantly, aside from learning how to learn anything, you start learning a couple skills like we were talking yesterday. If someone learned photography,
mm-hmm.
they can go around the world with a piece of equipment and be able to earn a living.
Right.
Right. So if you add a couple skills that give you the ability to go and make yourself of service or provide a product to people, then that gives you a lot of self-confidence to do and explore other areas. It's just like, if you don't go someplace because you're afraid you're going to get stuck, well, you make yourself an expert of getting unstuck, and then you can go off-road wherever you want to go.
Right. Right.
Right?
Yep.
So that's the idea, the metaphor through which we can learn.
Awesome. All my things better now.